newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where we talk about what's going on in American journalism and give some insight into ethical decision-making in our local newsrooms. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now creating the Upstate American, published by Substack. And I am here with my colleagues, Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo. Judy Patrick, the former editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady. Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and The Record. Here we are, surviving.
You know, when are we going to turn the corner on this morass we're in? Let's talk about the media morass. It seems when is the light going to come up? When are we going to get out of the darkness and have things improve? Why am I so pessimistic?
Well, maybe
this
in this
today?
Next half hour, we will solve all those problems.
But don't you think that light by light, little bit by little bit, there are beacons? I mean, I think the rise of independent nonprofit newsrooms is a real step forward from the collapse of American journalism. I mean, not to sugarcoat it, we have lost 70% per capita of the journalists who were working 20 years ago. So journalism is not in good shape, but there's wonderful journalism being done in these nonprofit newsrooms around the country, right?
There are examples of good journalism, great journalism being done, and from outlets that we wouldn't even normally think of if we're like New York Times, Washington Post kind of people. But for every great thing that's happening, I feel beaten down.
Yeah, there are a lot of stories that our newsrooms that we led no longer are able to cover, or the stories that just don't get covered because of the paucity of coverage.
Right, and as we know, it's hard to measure a negative. I want quantity. We're getting some quality, it's true. I want quantity now at this point. I want more news. I mean, not more of the same. I want especially more local news.
That was always an issue. And think of the Saratogian was very aware of it. And we came to a point where I felt we were covering the square block around the newspaper, whatever we could see out the window. But over the years, there was a decline. And we'd have people covering the surrounding towns. So you really felt like the area that you thought was the Saratogian territory was being well or decently covered, at least by reporters. And over time, like long before the internet came, I felt we didn't have enough people to cover the rural towns.
I mean, I'm remembering when I was the managing editor of the Times Union, when we put five journalists in downtown Saratoga Springs as a new bureau. And what a concept that is to think about.
It was very annoying.
It was very annoying, Rex. I was there as well. It was a battleground.
It was. We were all eager for Saratoga County. It's quite something. And I was thinking about this in the context of the death last week of Donald Newhouse, who was the head of Advanced Publications, that is the newspapers owned by the Newhouse family. And I was reading this in his obituary. In 1999, near the height of his success, Advanced Newspapers had a combined circulation of 2.9 million. Think of that. Now, this was not only, big newspapers like this, the Star Ledger in New Jersey, but the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the Times-Picayune of New Orleans, the Oregonian of Portland, what a great newspaper that was, as well as smaller papers. And that all of that has virtually gone away. That is, those papers don't publish in print anymore. Syracuse.com is an example of a place that early on devoted itself entirely, almost entirely, I should say, to digital. And I remember at the time, the publisher there saying, we know we're leaving money on the table by not having some print advertising, but we are transitioning our community to digital. And in fact, Syracuse.com is one of the largest local digital sites now in the country, even though Syracuse itself is not that big. So maybe they made the right bet.
I think they did make the right bet. And there's an editor there who started at the Saratogian a million years ago and has been there for a few decades now. And they has so lived through that transition from print to digital. And they really do invest resources into providing a good news product. And You know, you have to be able to get past the paywall by paying for the news. Heaven forbid somebody has to pay for the news, but it is good. And I was interested in Mr. Newhouse and his investment, kind of an unassuming guy who invested in his products and believed in the news. And, you know, the Newhouse School at Syracuse University was always, I thought, a good place to try to pick graduates to start the business.
Mm-hmm. That was opened with a founding gift from his father in 1964, who started with just the Staten Island Advance. That was the first newspaper, what became this big chain. But then in 2020, they pledged another $75 million to the Newhouse School. So that family really has made a great difference in that community.
Right. Speaking of family, I mean, this is an example of a legacy family newspaper investment, like the Hearst. And I never worked for a Newhouse publication, but the story was they were a great publication to work for, that they took good care of their employees. And I, too, echo the love of the Newhouse School and what they have produced in terms of fine journalists over the years, people you can really rely on to drop into your newsroom and get on the beat.
I think we need to recognize how many of those individual commitments to great journalism made a difference. I'm thinking of the Chandler family of Los Angeles, who I used to work for when I was at Newsday. They created another wonderful newspaper chain at Times Mirror that ended up getting bought out by Tribune, which ended up getting bought out by one of the hedge funds that Barbara's familiar with, having worked for them. And so the difficulty is these great families that shaped American journalism with their financial support. The Seattle Times is another one, the Blethyn family. And
the Grahams at the Washington Post.
The Grahams, of course.
And then you got the Murdochs.
And the Sulzbergers,
of course,
at the New York Times.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we would wish for more of those people to step forward now. Now, the good news is that some people are investing in, again, the charities that are supporting nonprofit newsrooms. So they're is that coming along? People who are supporting, there has been great family investment in public media and in public radio as well, you know. The notably Kroc Foundation, of course, supported NPR significantly. So we appreciate that. If there are any uber wealthy people out there, let me urge you, for your civic responsibility, do something for the good of journalism.
Right, and read the biography of Katharine Graham first so you get a sense of what we expect of you, which is ethics and a concern for the First Amendment and the fact that you're shepherding an important democratic institution. Don't just buy it for the love of owning a newspaper.
You think Mr. Bezos isn't?
Yeah, I think he needs to read that.
That would be, you think, a fundamental of the person who owns the Washington Post, wouldn't it be? They probably don't read books. He's probably like his favorite president.
Isn't that the thing with Amazon? The books?
That is, you would think. It's the Media Project, folks. We welcome your letters, media@wamc.org. I'm Rex Smith here with Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick. Speaking of letters, Roger in Utica writes to us, who says, I like your program and listen to it almost weekly.
Almost.
We go all the way out to Utica?
You know, you can catch up anytime at WAMC.org.
Oh, wow. What a great thing. And you can even make your donations. How about that? On presidential profanity and insults, Roger writes about, which we talked about last week. He said, this would have to happen with the authority of the news agency so the reporter is not left high and dry. So he suggests when Trump says a variation of you and your paper are reprehensible, or what a stupid question, you should be ashamed of yourself, or not you, piggy, which he said to a woman reporter in the White House, the very next journalist called upon should ask, Mr. President, why did you have to be so rude or mean or obnoxious or insulting to the previous reporter? Expect an obnoxious or rude response and refusal to answer. The next person should ask the same. This would almost certainly end the press conference or interviews. So now, it's a really interesting question. Why don't journalists follow up and defend their colleagues in this way?
I think that we are trained to, or had been trained to, just suck it up and to not become part of the story and to just take it and then try to proceed with our head held as high as possible.
In some respects, I agree, but I also think there's a little bit of ego involved here. You know, they want to be the one that asks the question that makes the news the next day. Mm. The fact is that President Trump holds so many media opportunities that why not give it a shot? Try it once. They're doing this almost once a day. What do you got to lose? I don't think you're going to lose any trust. The right-wing media may complain about it, but I think it'd be fun. Let's do it. Show some spine.
I think so, too. Do you agree?
I think it'd be terrific, but I haven't seen it happen. You know, I'm thinking of competitive reporting situations, for example, at the state capitol, where I've been engaged as a young reporter. That didn't happen when the governor would shoot down a question. You would think that the next reporter would say, well, let me ask it if I could a different question, and then say the same question.
Yeah, but we're not trained to do that. You're not going back to your newsroom and your editor hadn't said, you know, what you should have done for next time. So it's not a culture to do that, but I think it needs to be. There was an article recently in Editor and Publisher magazine by Gretchen Peck, and she addresses this and some of the misogyny. And what I thought was interesting part of it, where she interviewed a woman who's president of the International Women's Media Foundation, which was something I didn't know existed. But the person who is the president of that said, when the president is asked a question and his response, instead of answering it, is to mock, deride, put down the person asking the question, and then the next person just asks their question, that she asks the question, how do you create an environment where you're not allowing that deflection to happen? And that IWMF person says that couldn't believe that nobody was standing up for that person, that people should do what we've discussed, that you've got to stand up and say, you ask the same question again, at the very least. And I think there's also a place to say, even though it might be the last day that you'll get into the White House room, to say, treat us with dignity, please.
Do you think that it could part of it come from the fact that the president has made his anti-DEI strategy a political choice? Do you think that women reporters, who he tends to single out, he really attacks women reporters far more than men. Do you think that maybe reporters are afraid of being labeled anti-Trump if they stand up for women?
Well, they're afraid of getting kicked out.
I think there's a little bit of the media bending over backwards to present the perspective that they aren't DEI and they aren't anti-Trump, that they're going too far. This is totally inappropriate. I mean, I see it when you watch a press conference and you watch CNN and you'll hear the anchor say, our Caitlin Collins asked this question of the president. I mean, that gives them a chit, you know, when it comes to their brand and their ability to advance their career. There is that incentive there for
now
that to
happen.
Now that
makes me think that I want to contact the head of the White House press corps, whatever they're called, and ask this question.
Right. Why don't you do that? Well, that's an interesting question.
Let's have him on the program.
Let's see if we can.
I'll do some homework.
Okay. That's a great idea. We'll see if
we can get an answer
for our listeners. Yes. Thank you, letter writer. Very good. No, thanks, Roger. We do appreciate that. Roger in Utica, who also says, by the way, thank you so much for NPR, the network that is brought here, and discussing these issues in a thoughtful way, and with PBS NewsHour, the most credible and honest sources of news domestically. So we do appreciate hearing from you, media at WAMC.org, and sometimes we can actually bring this sort of stuff together and talk about it. And we appreciate your suggestions for what we ought to talk about. What happens, folks, when we get it wrong as journalists? I think this is a valid question because we make mistakes sometimes. We recognize that there are errors, otherwise there wouldn't be correction columns published. But, you know, you're sometimes caught, aren't you, between wanting to acknowledge your errors and take care of them, realizing that sometimes the public, your consumers, will not understand why you went into print with something that turns out not to be right. How do we deal with the issue of mistaken drifts, directions of stories, versus mistakes, simply errors that need corrections, the way somebody has named, for example?
Right. Errors of facts are relatively easy to correct. Errors of whether or not you should have done a story, whether that was the mistake or whether it took a wrong direction, those are more difficult to correct. If I had a nickel for every time I had someone say, well, you made the mistake in big type on the front page, I want the correction in big type on the front page, I'd be a millionaire.
Well, do we usually make mistakes in big type on the front page? I'm trying to think of stories where a whole direction is wrong. I don't know. It's difficult.
I remember when I worked in Amsterdam, we had a senator announcing he was going to seek another four-year term. That was a U.S. senator.
Oops.
Those are six-year terms. That was a big four.
Okay, but that's like a technical error.
Yeah.
That's a brain lapse is what that is.
Yeah. My concern with errors is how they are corrected so that somebody actually ever learns that there's a correction made to a story. And it was really difficult in print because it was in a little box somewhere that nobody really is going to look at. And now there's an opportunity with digital. when a story is changed, I think that at the top of the story, it should say, you know, this was modified from the original edition with a blah, 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 whatever it is. And then the story can read correct. But you hardly ever see that. And sometimes it means you should also repost a story so that people will be made aware that there was a correction made.
That is usually what's being done these days. Isn't that the standard now, is to change a story and put a notation, this story originally appeared and that has been updated, at least
sometimes
certainly.
That's at the end of a story,
yeah.
That
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't even under good circumstances get to the end of the story.
You know, ideally, we don't look at corrections as failures. They're actually a form of honesty. You know, our job is to get it right. I mean, everybody makes mistakes, but if you are a journalist and you make a mistake, you do a correction, you do a clarification. Unlike a politician who rarely will admit to making a mistake or an error of judgment in a vote that was wrong or something.
Yeah, it could be tricky because if something is out of context, then you sort of have some angst because it could have been done better, but is it incorrect or is it just not as good as we wished it had been? You know, is it worth redoing? And I remember always having some staff members that balked at, we don't really need apologizing with a correction, and just said, we just need a clarification.
Yeah, right.
And sometimes the clarification is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tried to establish an atmosphere in the newsroom where people were not afraid to come to me and say, I made a mistake, we need a correction, because that does happen. And what you want to say is, it's important that the record be clear and correct, and don't try to hide your mistakes. I eventually will find out. Don't try to suppress it.
Right. We as editors, as newsroom leaders, though, were often held to a standard by our staffs, I think, of saying, are you going to stand up for your staff? Will you back up your reporters? And when you find that your reporter really might have a bad sensibility about someone or might really be misunderstanding a politician, that's a very difficult situation to deal with.
Well, that's our job to make sure that they learn from that experience. And if they can't understand it, they might be in the wrong line of work. I used to have a policy with staff asking them to, kind of expecting them to contact the person who was wronged. It might have been as simple as a misspelling or, you know, something in the story that was incorrect, to just say, I just want to let you know that I feel terrible that I goofed that up. We put a correction in, just to help to maintain sources and build respect, saying, we'll admit that we're wrong and we'll actually apologize to someone. You see it in lawsuits. People would be happy just to get an apology sometimes. I'm sorry I made that mistake.
You know, we always had the debate about whether or not to say we regret the error. You know, that was
of course you.
That was a loaded argument. And then the other thing to think about with a correction is, once you correct something, you're essentially republishing it, so the libel clock starts anew. If you find the 365-day statute of limitations is about to run out, and on the 364th day you run a correction, you've restarted your clock. I know that shouldn't
matter.
Sounds
like a publisher.
Yeah, that's a publisher issue.
It is a really interesting question that your lawyers would bring up. To correct an error mitigates the claim that might be filed against you at a certain level, but it also does restart the clock. It also does give credence to an argument if there's going to be a libel claim.
Usually, the vast majority of the errors are sloppiness.
Yes, absolutely. And
not ill intention.
The ones where you tend to get in legal trouble, that's not just errors, but where you actually have the potential to have affected somebody's credibility, they tend to be little things. You know, the big stories get so carefully reviewed, but the worst libel trouble we got into during my tenure in editorships was from a 4-inch story that was basically reasserting what a previous story had said, but more sloppily presented. And that little story is what we ended up getting sued on and ended up having to do depositions and so on.
You really regretted that error.
I regret.
And you know, that's the point, is the fact that every day, every media company puts out so much information, thousands of facts, thousands of sentences, thousands of potential problems. And that is why the Supreme Court has given us a little bit of grace, that unless we've done something intentionally and knew it was wrong and published it anyways, give us a little grace, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to publish. You wouldn't be able to do your jobs. And so we do it the best we can. And when we make a mistake, we fess up.
I noticed something interesting in the readings from the Poynter Institute, which is the journalism training and think tank, that they conceived of and have a project of something called the Indianapolis Public Editor Project. So the Indianapolis area has a person who's now their public editor, and it's not just for one media company, it's for multiple media companies, and it's funded by the Hearst Foundation and the Lumina Foundation, a philanthropic nonprofit. And so she, Tracy Compton, the person who's been hired into that job, wrote a pretty interesting article discussing dealing with mistakes and owning up to them. And the fact that I've never heard before of there being a public editor who's covering more than just the individual market.
Well, in the 1960s, actually, there was an effort for a National News Council.
That's why we have you here, Rex. That's
you know,
you're
old.
Like our historian.
A National News Council was going to be the sort of watchdog. Everybody would collaborate with it, and there would be this group that people could bring their concerns about errors, about bias, about any kind of effort that would go forward, and it really almost took off. And then both CBS News, which was then the leading broadcast organization, and the New York Times decided they wouldn't participate, and that kind of killed it. There have been regional news councils, but it has never quite taken off. So these efforts often have fallen apart, notwithstanding.
Yeah, I like the idea, though.
It is a good idea. And she discusses also the difficulty of dealing with mistakes when you're broadcast media.
We
should hear from David sometime about David Gustine, about the radio angle.
Well, broadcast media rarely correct their mistakes. I've noticed that, with all due respect, television news, of course, they basically pick up the news that we produce from print, in my judgment. But where?
What?
Where do you...
The silent voice, you've awoken him.
I have made corrections myself over the air, Mr. Rex Smith. We do it a little differently in public radio.
Excellent. Television news rarely corrects its errors. You know, when have you ever heard that kind of thing going on broadcast television? So it is a different standard, frankly.
Yeah, and even when it's well-intentioned in the radio end, the challenge is how to make sure people heard that you're correcting there. So you do the right thing by correct it, and then you hope that people who need to... Or might be on a website, perhaps.
Yeah. Websites give us all the opportunity to make it better. Okay, we've talked a lot about errors, and let's just do one quick thing here toward the end about live streaming, because it's such an interesting notion. Young people these days are now getting their news from YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, and so if you're a journalist, you need to go where your audience is. So the way to reach a young audience these days, isn't it, would be to live stream the news on YouTube, to go to TikTok with your reports. And I'm just surprised that we haven't seen more of that, that we haven't seen news organizations really embrace going out with a camera right away and being on the scene.
Wasn't there some of that, like back in the, not that back in the day, way, way, way back day, but back in the other day, when Facebook was coming out
Facebook
and there would
Live.
Be lives. So we were doing that. Actually, the Gazette was doing it quite a bit.
Yeah, a lot of Facebook Live, you'd cover parades, you'd cover kind of events where people were moving, you know, but you run into trouble because if you have background noise of copyrighted music, then you'd run into trouble, they'd shut it down. But I think there are opportunities. The problem is sometimes these things are just like weather events or boring meetings. I mean, I think you really need an imaginative reporter to take it and plan. Because as much as we like the idea of live events and maybe people watching things unfold before our very eyes, really good journalism requires some planning, don't you think?
Yeah, that's true. And that's why editing and writing and culling what's more important out of stuff.
We are such old fogies, aren't we?
But it's true. It is true that live often is boring.
Yeah.
And live is not as exciting as you might think it would be. But
prove us wrong.
but if there's breaking news and TV does it, your radio does it, if there's something really breaking and it's usually going to be some tragedy, an accident or something.
Or a bear in a tree.
Right, something important.
Really important.
Then you do get there and you've got your live feed.
Yeah. Okay, we'll probably see more of it as it goes along, but it is clearly going to make a difference in trying to reach young viewers.
Send me some links. Prove me wrong.
Let's see if that's true. All right, we are out of time for this week. We have had an interesting conversation about a wide variety of topics. Judy Patrick, Barbara Lombardo, and I'm Rex Smith, with gratitude to the producer, Dave Gustina. And we thank you for joining us. We hope you'll come back again next week for The Media Project.
Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling, ling-a-ling, ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage.
They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, and Raga Justin, Albany bureau chief for Bloomberg Government. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.